Welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 9th of April 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how is life treating you?
Usual, you know. Kicked every day of the week, but at least I'm surviving.
Are you feeling a little bit better? You were sort of feeling a bit down last week, recovering from all your operations and the rest of it.
Yeah, I've had a couple of late nights. So I think it was Tuesday I did an interview with Renz, believe it or not, who was absolutely praising in The Greatest Story Never Told. I could not have believed if he'd have sent me the script.
Wow, that's a turn up for the books. Jeff Renz is, I mean, he's more interested in the sort of David Icke, Henry Mackell sort of thing, isn't he? Yeah. So when did he see Greatest Story Never Told then?
Well, he bought it recently and quote, if you like, the greatest documentary of the century.
Fantastic. That is praise, isn't it? Coming from somebody as well known as Jeff Renz. I mean, that is really good.
It was all after that.
I bet you were. What was it, an hour-long interview you did with him?
Just an hour, and it just went like me and you, just went Zoom.
Do you know what time of day it was on over there?
Well, it was 3 o'clock over here, I think we're 8 hours in front, so probably about 7 or 8.
So evening show, prime time.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I should imagine that you'll get some more sales of the DVD through that as well. Did he promote that too?
Well, I wished it unbelievably. In fact, he played the trailer at the beginning, the one where, you know, where the guy's talking and Deanna Spingola is saying, you know, it's an honor to have you on the show and all this. He actually played that right at the beginning.
That is really good news. And just to let listeners know, they can purchase the DVD at moneytreepublishing.com. And we're also hoping to get Communism by the Back Door up there. Is that
for sale yet?
That is there now. Brilliant. Listeners can also purchase that. How are the sales of it doing, Dennis?
Well, reasonably well. I mean, there's been no mail out yet for Communism by the Back Door, but I think that's going to be an interesting one because of what recently went on in America. Hitler predicted if Germany lost the war, what would happen to America, which is exactly what's happening.
So that's the test of a true prophet, isn't it? If what he prophesies comes true.
There's another prophet here, by the way. I don't know if you're aware or not, but a couple of weeks back, Ukraine declared war on Russia. And Russia have been moving tanks to the Crimea. And the document is actually been found by somebody on the internet. And one wonders if it's the Biden people behind it all. We'll have to wait and see.
Encouraging Ukraine to take steps against Russia.
I don't think they do it on their own, do they?
No. Well, they are pretty much just a puppet of America. Yeah, I'd heard that the troops had been moved closer to the Ukraine border, but I didn't know the details of it.
Tanks and everything. They're taking it serious, I believe, Putin.
Well, you can't blame them, can you? And look at what they're fighting against. Transsexuals and pregnant women in pregnant... flight jet jumpsuits or whatever it is. It's just laughable, isn't it, looking at the
Well, that's the same that they want the Crimea, they're going to get the Crimea. Well, Putin's not going to give them, so, you know, it must be war then.
Well, I read something about he was saying if any Russian is killed or hurt in any way in the Crimea, that Russia will retaliate. I did read that somewhere.
As I said, Biden and his hawks are well aware of the situation.
I must admit, I haven't really been keeping up on that. I've been hard at work on getting notes together for tonight's show. Just before we get into that, have you managed to get any more work done on Churchill's body count?
No, actually, what I had to do this week were I had to remake the trailer for Communism by the Back Door which I still haven't quite finished yet. I have to, believe it or not, I was thinking I had to rip part 20 of The Secret Masonic Victory because I spelled Barack Obama with two R's. And later I found out it was a host of books on Amazon with Barack Obama with two R's. So that saved me a bit of work there. I mean, so much so simple, like, you know, it does take a while. So it's due, don't worry.
Excellent. Well, a lot of these African names or non-white names, they're spelt in different ways because they're not English names anyway. So the English the English spelling of it can vary. Well, tonight we're going to continue with our little mini series here on Jewish emigration in the Third Reich, mainly using Ingrid Weckert's book by the same title, but we also have some notes from Wikipedia and some from some other sites in tonight's show. And before we get into that, there was a comment that was sent in, an email was sent in by James Pattinson, and he writes that we did not make it clear last week that the phrase Judea declares war on Germany was a trade war and not a military war, as world Jewry who issued the demand for the boycotts had no military. And we did go into that. We did go into that in the first episode. Yeah. We went into that in quite some detail in the first episode. So, I mean, it should be taken that when Judea declares war on Germany is a headline, that there was no country of Judea, there was no military. It was just a turn of phrase that these Jewish representatives were using. World Jewry, they called themselves, didn't they?
International Jewry, yes.
That was their title. Well, he says, it cannot be argued, therefore, that interning Jews was a proportionate response to the same degree as a country facing a genuine military threat. And the comparison, philosophically speaking, would be a false equivalence. And we didn't say that. We didn't say they were interning Jews for being Jews. Jews were not interned for being agents of a foreign enemy until the war had started, the hot war, the military war. Up to that point and beyond, for some, they were just seen as guests in the country, being no longer citizens.
Yeah, but I think starving a country into submission is an act of war, whichever way you look at it. Which they've done previously in World War One, and they're intending to do it again in 1933.
Good point there. Well, they were no longer citizens, as citizenship was then based upon biological inheritance, but they were still seen as guests, and there was still a law. The National Socialists weren't breaking the law. It was only communists and threats to the state that were imprisoned in the same way that we imprison terrorists today. Dennis, do you know, when the war actually started, were Jews imprisoned for being Jews, or was it still just if they were a threat to the state?
Well, I think they would have been put in prison when immediately Hitler came to power because, you know, within a matter of days, Judea declared war on Germany. And so there would have been Jews in Germany, enemies of the state. So that would have probably gone up even right up to the end of the war.
Well, that can't be so that all Jews were put in prison, because the whole series we've been doing so far has been the Zionist federations working with the National Socialists to get the Jews to Palestine, and they had all these various different organizations, and they all had their various different newspapers, and they weren't doing that from behind prison fencing. So it must have been that they were free, and the only people that were actually put in prison were communists. So
and Masons and some left-wing priests who were warned not to flee from the pulpit.
And then you sent in an article that you sent me today, Dennis. Where did you get this from?
I had it in Communism by the Back Door.
Right, so it's a piece from the documentary. And it says, when Germany realised that Jews were overrepresented among those responsible for her defeat in the First World War, they naturally resented it, but not a hair on the head of any Jew was harmed, not a single hair. Professor Tansil of Georgetown University, who had access to all the secret papers of the State Department, wrote in his book, quoting from a State Department document written by Hugo Schoenfeld, a Jew whom Cordell Hull sent to Europe in 1933 to investigate the so-called camps of political prisoners. He wrote back that he found them in very fine condition. They were in excellent shape, with everybody treated well, and the camps were actually filled with communists. And a lot of them were Jews, because Jews happened to comprise a very large percentage of all the communists in Europe at that time. But there were also some priests there, and ministers, and labour leaders, and Masons and others who had international affiliations. So it was enemies of the state that were imprisoned, not being imprisoned for their religion or being imprisoned because they were Jews. And as you say, Dennis, starving a nation into submission is really an act of war, isn't it?
Well, without a doubt, after World War One, they starved over a million to get Germany to come and sign the death warrant called Versailles.
So it was within living memory what that sort of thing could do to a country.
Yeah. They bragged about it, so we've done it before, we'll do it again.
How many
people? So, you know, it's a serious threat.
Well, you could also say, though, that the Germans would have said, well, these German Jews, they're also going to be starved.
Which they were, which is crazy.
So either way, world Jewry, the representatives of the Jewish organisations, they really were not showing much concern for the Jews that were in Germany at the time. More concern was being shown for them by the National Socialists.
Same goes for the non-National Socialist Germans, the left-wing Germans. They're going to suffer as well.
And a lot of the left-wing Germans would have been put in the camps as well.
Yeah, well, they're on both sides, aren't they?
For being communists. Well, getting back to Jewish immigration in the Third Reich, again, I'll just give what Ingrid Weckert states is her reason for writing this. She says, emigration is not some kind of wild flight, leaving all your money and possessions behind, but rather a lawfully determined and regulated matter. The purpose of this work is to elucidate the emigration process in law and policy, thereby augmenting the traditionally received picture of Jewish emigration from Germany during the Third Reich. So that's the point of doing this. We're just expanding upon the mainstream narrative that everybody knows. And I'm particularly pleased with the information that we've got tonight, because it's some really original stuff here that I wasn't aware of until looking into it. And also I found confirmation of everything that we've discussed so far on an obscure page on Wikipedia that wasn't actually titled Israel or Palestine or Germany and Palestine or anything like that. It was just on the page to do with this Baron Leopold von Mildenstein, who we'll get into in a minute. And we'll start with a recap of where we got to. We talked about how there was resistance to the Havarah Agreement in Germany, as it was disadvantaging the German foreign exchange market, and Jews were being given special privileges that Germans didn't have, such as being able to leave the country without paying a special tax. In spite of this, Hitler was determined that it should continue, which it did right up until 1941. We talked about how the SS helped the Zionists to build retraining camps to prepare the young Jews for the hard work involved in bringing Palestine out of the desert and into the industrial age. Eichmann may well have been right when he told the court that he had saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of Jews by helping them to emigrate. Unlike Britain, who had limited immigration to Palestine to just 15,000 a year. We also highlighted the number of Jews that actually fought for Germany and how keen they were to show their German side was stronger in them than their Jewish side. So this was the other side to it. You had the Zionists, who the National Socialists were encouraging to be Jewish, and then you had the Mischlings, who were very keen to show that they were German. So they would do lots of acts of bravado when they were actually in the army. And we talked about Leopold von Mildenstein, who had the medal struck with the Jewish star on one side and the swastika on the other, and how he stayed in Palestine for a year while writing a travelogue for Goebbels magazine, Der Angriff. And that's who I really wanted to take a closer look at today, because he's got a really interesting story. But before we get into that, is there anything in that summary there, Dennis, that you want to pick up on?
Not really, no. We covered most of what you just said last week. So I'd be interested to know myself about this guy, Leopold.
Right, well, he was born in 1902 in Prague, then part of Austria-Hungary, and Mildenstein belonged to the lowest tier of the Austrian nobility, and he was brought up as a Roman Catholic. And he does appear to be Aryan. I don't think he was Jewish, even though he's got Stein as the last part of his name. He trained as an engineer and joined the NSDAP in 1929, receiving the membership number 106678. So he was an early member of the National Socialists. What date was it when the NSDAP actually formed, Dennis? Do you know?
Maybe about 1920, weren't it?
1920. So they'd actually been going for about 10 years by the time that he joined. So not really a founding member, but before they got elected anyway. In 1932, he joined the SS, becoming one of the first Austrians to do so. According to Dieter Vishlini, his former SS colleague, Mildenstein visited the Middle East, including British-administered Palestine, several times up to 1935. And we'll get into one of those times in a minute. Mildenstein had taken an early interest in Zionism, even going so far as to attend Zionist conferences to help deepen his understanding of the movement. He actively promoted Zionism as a way out of the official impasse on the Jewish question, as a way of making Germany Judenrein, free of Jews. Some Zionists, whose movement had grown tremendously in popularity among German Jews since Hitler came to power, cooperated. On the 7th of April 1933, the Jüdische Rundschau, the biweekly paper of the Zionist movement, declared that out of all the Jewish groups, only the Zionist Federation of Germany was capable of approaching the National Socialists in good faith as honest partners. And they actually sent a memorandum from the Zionist Federation to the NSDAP, and I've got a quote from that here. They said, "Zionism believes that the rebirth of the national life of a people, which is now occurring in Germany through the emphasis on its Christian and national character, must also come about in the Jewish national group. For the Jewish people too, national origin, religion, common destiny and a sense of its uniqueness must be of decisive importance in the shaping of its existence. Because we too are against mixed marriage and are for maintaining the purity of the Jewish group, and we reject any trespasses in the cultural domain." I'd really like to have found more of that, more about the cultural side of it. But it looks like, you know, the Jews didn't want the Jews to become Germanified. They didn't want the Christian influence, and the National Socialists didn't want the Jewish influence. So both groups really wanted the same thing.
Yeah, separate.
Yeah, well, this is it, and this is how they did it. And obviously, there were other Jewish groups; otherwise, they wouldn't have said, "We're the only ones that can approach the National Socialists as honest partners." So they weren't happy with the other groups. And also, as it says here, the Zionist grouping was the one that was expanding the most. There was a massive explosion in Jews becoming Zionists. Becoming nationalists, basically. They were seeing the benefits that it was bringing to the German people, and they wanted those benefits for themselves as well. And this was also encouraged, obviously, by the SS. Well, the Zionist Federation of Berlin then commissioned Kurt Tuckler to make contact with possible Zionist sympathisers within the NSDAP, and Kurt Tuckler was a Jew. And this was with the aim of facilitating emigration to Palestine. And Tuckler approached Mildenstein, who was asked to write something positive about Jewish Palestine in the press. Mildenstein agreed on the condition that he be allowed to visit the country in person with Tuckler as his guide. So in the spring of 1933, a party of four set out from Berlin, consisting of Mildenstein, Tuckler and their wives. They spent a month together in Palestine, and Mildenstein began to write a series of articles for Der Angriff, Goebbels newspaper in Berlin. Mildenstein himself remained in Palestine for a total of 6 months before his return to Germany as an enthusiast for Zionism, and he even began to study Hebrew. In August 1933, Hitler's government and the German Zionists entered into the Havara Agreement, which encouraged emigration by allowing Jews to transfer property and funds from Germany to Palestine. So we can see here that straight away the Jews are asking the National Socialists for some benefits, some privileges. They're saying, will you write us something positive about this country that we want to build? And the SS and Mildenstein is saying, well, we're more than happy to do that. And can I go there and have a look as well and see this birth of a new country, how it's done, basically, nation building? I mean, it must have been really interesting for him to see this going on. And it's a part of the story that's hidden.
Sorry, I was just wondering, maybe somebody in the chat room will know, but when did the actual boycott finish?
I'm not sure it ever did it?
I don't know. I mean, war came in, what, 1939? But the transfer agreement ended in 1941. I don't know.
I don't think the boycott was ever lifted. I think.
Well, I know they never rescinded the Holy War Declaration. So, I don't know.
Well, you could say that was like a Cold War, and then once it started militarily, that was a hot war, with the other countries of the world joining in, but militarily.
Yeah.
And it's definitely like a progression on from that statement in the press, and that was when the isolation of Germany began, wasn't it?
Well, the problem is the Jews are behind Roosevelt, people like that, to start the war, because they were saying that the Jews were suffering in Germany when you just admit yourself like that they went over there investigating and everything was fine. And even in that newspaper headline where Goebbels asked, name me one Jew that has been killed, so they would be pushing for that military war even though this boycott was on.
And the headline is the image that we'll use for the podcast so people can see that. And also there's a picture there of somebody who is obviously in Britain and they're protesting boycott German goods. So this was going in Britain and in America, in all the other countries around the world that had Jews in them, basically. They were all advocating and lobbying their governments to boycott Germany, which a lot of them did. On his return to Berlin, Mildenstein's suggestion that the solution to the Jewish problem lay in mass migration to Palestine was accepted by his superiors within the SS. From August 1934 to June 1936, Mildenstein worked in the headquarters of the SD, the security service of the SS, in section 11/112, in charge of the Jewish desk, with the title of Jewish Affairs Officer. This title meant that he was responsible for reporting on Jewish affairs under the overall command of Reinhard Heydrich. And that was what I was questioning last week from the notes when it was saying the Jewish section of the SS. So there was this Jewish office, this Jewish desk, and it was Mildenstein who was in charge of it. During those years, Mildenstein favoured a policy of encouraging Germany's Jewish population to emigrate to Palestine, and in pursuit of this policy, he developed positive contacts with the Zionist organisations. SS officials were even instructed to encourage the activities of the Zionists within the Jewish community, who were to be favoured over the assimilationists, who were said to be the real danger to the nation's integrity. Even the Nuremberg Laws of September 1935 had a special Zionist provision allowing the Jews to fly their own flag. So that confirms what we were talking about last week about how the SS were actually paying for land so that these camps could be built upon them. And it was the SS and the Gestapo that the Zionists would go to if they were having a problem with the population, or if there were officials that weren't treating them very nicely, then it was the SS that they would go to, and it was the SS that would protect them. And they were seen as preferable to the assimilationists, who, because you wouldn't want them to be entering into a romance with a German, say, because then you would end up with more Mischlings.
Well, I think this is where people get confused when they say that Hitler was working with the Zionists. It's just both were pulling each other, to do this, because obviously Germany wanted rid of alien elements, and the Jews wanted their own land, so it was in everybody's interests.
It was mutually beneficial, because what you've got is you've got nationalists. You've got nationalists on the German side, and you've got nationalists on the Jewish side.
On the other side, yeah.
And they're both nationalists, so they're going to get on. They're both going to want the same thing. Any hostility is just not really going to be there, is it? Because they're both going to understand that they both want the same thing, and they're both doing the right thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Doing the best thing for their people, and you've got to admire that, no matter who the person is. If they're doing their best for their people, that's admirable. It's like John Magufuli, who just died in bizarre circumstances, shall we say, in Tanzania. Yeah. And he was a nationalist leader, and he was doing great things for his people. He's black, but what he was doing was very admirable. And I think this is the way that the National Socialists saw the Zionists. It was an admirable thing that they were doing. They were building a new country in a place that was really backwards. They still had camels and donkeys. They didn't have motor engines and railways. That was all being built by these young Jews who weren't used to doing hard work. They had to be specially trained up to go over to Palestine to then do the digging and do the hard work. So, you know, not something that most Jews are used to doing.
I say, it is accountants.
Yeah.
And pushing somewhere else like that.
And also to think that, you know, there was this big growth in Zionism as well, this big growth in this Jewish nationalism as well. I mean, that's quite an achievement as well, because you would think that they didn't want to get their hands dirty or they didn't want to get involved in it. But they did, and they saw the benefits it brought to the Germans to be nationalists, and they wanted that for themselves. And then next we have a little bit about Adolf Eichmann. Adolf Eichmann believed that his big break came in 1934 when he had a meeting with Mildenstein, a fellow Austrian in the Wilhelmstrasse, and was invited to join Mildenstein's department. Eichmann later stated that Mildenstein rejected the vulgar anti-Semitism of Stryker. Soon after his arrival in the section, Mildenstein gave Eichmann a book on Judaism by Adolf Bohm, a leading Jew from Vienna. So you've got two different ways of dealing with what they would call anti-Semitism there. So you've got the Stryker version, which may be the more cartoonish version, and then I guess you've got the scientific version, probably be more like Professor Kevin MacDonald, what he studies, and Mildenstein is definitely on the scientific side of things rather than the cartoonish side of things. And between 9th of September and 9th of October 1934, the newspaper Der Angriff published a series of 12 quite pro-Zionist reports titled A Nazi Goes to Palestine by Mildenstein, to which honour the newspaper issued a commemorative medallion cast with the swastika on one side and the Star of David on the other. So that explains why it had the wording a Nazi on it instead of a National Socialist, and what they were trying to do there. In the summer of 1935, then holding the rank of SS Untersturmführer, Mildenstein attended the 19th Congress of the Zionist Organisation in Lucerne, Switzerland, as an observer attached to the German Jewish delegation. So when you hear about that, that the SS had an official representative attached to the German Jewish delegation at the Zionist Congress in Switzerland, and you just don't hear that anywhere, do you? That they
no, but it couldn't have been easy for SS, because they would have known a lot of Jews just didn't like Germans, and to work with some of them might have been okay, but there would have been others putting blockings in.
Oh, certainly.
I'm sure.
Certainly, that's what I mean. This shows you that you know, there were relationships between the Germans and the Jews that were beneficial to both of them. This Mildenstein, he actually remained friends with this Jewish friend that he went to stay in Palestine with, and he remained friends with him after the war as well.
Mm.
Mildenstein's apparently pro-Zionist line was overtaken by events, and after a dispute with Reinhard Heydrich in 1936, he was removed from his post and transferred to the Foreign Ministry's press department. Now, I would question that, because I've also read that he resigned. There was no dispute. He wasn't removed from his post. He just resigned, and we're not quite sure why he resigned. But they say here he had fallen out of favour because migration to Palestine was not proceeding at a fast enough rate. Well, he couldn't speed it up. It was dependent on how many Jews Britain said Palestine was allowed to accept.
Yeah.
And that was just 15,000 a year. So, I mean, he could hardly speed that up, could he? That was up to Britain.
Yeah.
His departure from the SD also saw a shift in SS policy, marked by the publication of a pamphlet warning of the dangers of a strong Jewish state in the Middle East, written by another expert on Jewish matters who had been invited to join Section 11/112 by Mildenstein himself, Eichmann. Mildenstein was replaced as the head of his former section by Kuno Schroeder, and later in December 1939, Eichmann was made chief of the Jewish department of the RSHA, which the SD became a part of in September 1939. Now, a pamphlet warning of the dangers of a strong Jewish state, that is more reminiscent of Hitler's own warnings about it in Mein Kampf, where he points out his own theories about what could happen is that Jewish criminals from other parts of the world would move there where they knew they would be safe. And that is what's happened, because there's no extradition agreement in Israel with any other country. So when you see Jews in Russia that have been accused of crimes, they head straight for Israel. And the same in America. It's a known thing that if they can get to Israel, they're safe. So that was one of his predictions there. Do you know much about Eichmann, Dennis?
Well, only that what they did after the war, you know, to go into a country and to kidnap him, it must have been against international law, but they got away with it, which is, you know, incredible, really.
Well, I think a lot of it could have been made up as well, because Eichmann said in the trial that he had saved the lives of hundreds of thousands of Jews.
And
the policy was to help Jews to emigrate, and it wasn't just to Palestine. I mean, we started last week on the other agreement. We'll get onto that in a bit. There wasn't just this agreement to help them emigrate to Palestine. They were emigrating everywhere, and it was this Jewish desk, this Jewish section of the SS that was responsible for that and for helping them to emigrate. So that is what he was doing. But then you've got all these allegations of extermination that went on that just come from these eyewitnesses, which a lot of them, that stories don't actually add up. And I think that was used against Eichmann. There is there's a book. Simon Shepherd has an English translation of Eichmann's memoirs, which people might be able to find at heretical.com. I think he's got it serialized there. And I think he is under the impression that any confession was brought out of Eichmann was brought out of him under duress. Rather, yes. as they say. But it's a shame.
That's most of them were, weren't they?
Yeah, well, it's a shame, because you've got people here that are, you know, Mildenstein is obviously a good man. He's trying to help the Jews out in the best way that helps Germany out as well, and he's trying to help them to move. So I'm glad to see he wasn't actually charged with misdeeds during the war. But maybe Eichmann was the same. Maybe Eichmann was the same. As Germany moved into the Second World War, Mildenstein continued to write propaganda articles and books, including Around the Burning Land of the Jordan in 1938 and The Middle East Seen from the Roadside in 1941. Now, there was also a bit that the SS did when they went digging around near Bethlehem, weren't they? And they dug up some of the bodies there. In an archaeological way, and they said that these remains are Aryan remains, they're not Semitic remains. So there must have been other instances where the Germans were actually in the Middle East. Do you recall where that bit comes from, Dennis? We mentioned it before in a podcast, didn't we?
Well, I looked into the fact that the Germans believed that Jesus was Aryan, and why. So there were definitely places down there where Jews didn't actually inhabit, and Galilee and places like that were part of that area. So, they probably combined the two trips to kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah, it could have been at the same time, with the archaeological dig. By 1934, the SS had become the most pro-Zionist element in the NSDAP. Other Germans were even calling them soft on the Jews. Baron von Mildenstein had returned from his six-month visit to Palestine as an ardent Zionist sympathizer. Now as the head of the Jewish department of the SS's security service, he started studying Hebrew and collecting Hebrew records. When his former companion and guide, Kurt Tuckler, visited his office in 1934, he was greeted by the strains of familiar Jewish folk tunes, and there were maps on the walls showing the rapidly increasing strength of Zionism inside Germany, obviously, because this was a positive thing. This meant that Jews were associating themselves with being Jews. Von Mildenstein was as good as his word. He not only wrote favourably about what he saw in the Zionist colonies in Palestine, he also persuaded Goebbels to run the report as a massive 12-part series in Der Angriff, the leading NSDAP propaganda organ. His stay among the Zionists had shown the SS man the way to curing a centuries-long wound on the body of the world, the Jewish question. And that's a quote. It was really amazing how some good Jewish Boden under his feet could enliven the Jew. Quote, the soil has reformed him and his kind in a decade. This new Jew will be a new people. Close quote. To commemorate the Baron's expedition, Goebbels had a medal struck on one side, the swastika, and on the other, the Zionist star. And I took that quote from a Jewish publication that gives us some more information about this. So what they're saying here, that nationalism helped to sort of bring the best out in the Jews, and working in the soil also helped them out. And this is his direct quote. The soil has reformed him and his kind in a decade. This new Jew will be a new people. And they obviously, you know, Jews saw this as being a positive thing. Got any comments you want to make, Dennis?
No, it's like I said, it's a two-way thing. I can't understand why people can't get their head around it. Because the main thing to me is the peaceful way that they went around trying to get them down to Israel. You know, we're told Hollywood and the history books, whatever, that the Germans hated all Jews, any Jew, which wasn't right. It wasn't true.
Well, it's quite clear that's not true here. They just wanted a peaceful separation. I mean, this is the thing. They're trying to push this idea that an ethno-state, it means ethnic cleansing, it means violence. It doesn't mean that at all. It means the waking up of a sense of love for your own people and understanding that other peoples of the world, they also have that love for their own people, and it just needs to be encouraged, and then great things can come out of it. And, you know, great, you know, Israel is a country that they managed to build for themselves. And I'm sure the Jews would say Israel was a great thing that came out of the nationalist spirit. And the Germans at the time of the Third Reich, they would also say the Third Reich was an amazing thing that came out of the nationalist spirit. We had 6 million unemployed, or 60 million, whatever it was, unemployed, and they all got back to work, and we had the economic miracle, and the rest of the world was in an economic slump. They were in a depression. And that's what nationalism did. It doesn't mean attacking others. And the other thing is, people will think nationalism, it's jingoism, it means invading other countries. And you can see here that it doesn't mean that. You've got the two people that are supposedly the worst enemies of each other, the National Socialists and the Zionists, or the Jews, and they're not. They're working together to help each other out, to separate. And the Germans are helping the Jews to build this homeland for themselves, and the Jews are also helping the Germans out in Germany by encouraging Jews to become Zionists. It's quite clearly not the Germans working for the Zionists, is it, as the conspiracy crowd?
No, as is often reported. Yeah.
We've got some statistics here. Between 1933 and 1941, some 60,000 of Germany's wealthiest and best-educated Jews, which was about 10% of Germany's 1933 Jewish population, emigrated to Palestine through the Havarah and other German Zionist arrangements. So think about that. It's the wealthiest and the best-educated Jews, and they're working on the farmland, and they're doing hard manual labour once they got there. So it's quite a change from what they were used to. And these German Jews then made up about 15% of Palestine's 1939 Jewish population. The total amount transferred from Germany to Palestine through the Havarah between August 1933 and the end of 1939 was £8.1 million, or 139.57 million German marks, which was then equivalent to more than $40 million, but the equivalent of $516 million in 2002 dollars, which is when this article was written. This amount included 33.9 million German marks provided by the Reichsbank in connection with the agreement. So that's 33.9 million German marks come from the German government to help out.
Yeah.
So that's not stealing from the Jews, is it?
No, and this is a country which was on its knees before Hitler came to power.
Yeah, and it's donating this money to help them out with the emigration. And as we mentioned before, the Jews weren't taxed in the way that Germans were if they wanted to emigrate. Several major industrial enterprises were built with the capital from Germany, including the Meckeroth Waterworks and the Lodzia textile firm. The influx of Havarah goods and capital produced an economic explosion in Jewish Palestine. And this is what I've having difficulties finding information on, as you know, as all the way through this, it's been hard to find websites that deal with this and talk about this history. And this is the first time I've actually found some of the things that were built by them, the waterworks and a textile firm. But there must have been a lot more. If you think 15% of the population there were these formerly German Jews. So it must have been a lot of the infrastructure that was built must have been built by them, and it's just covered up today. And they don't say what they actually did. After the war, Mildenstein's works were placed on the list of proscribed literature in the Soviet occupation zone and later in the German Democratic Republic. Like the Havarah Agreement, Mildenstein's visit to Palestine in 1933, the medal to commemorate it, and the pro-Zionist articles in Der Angriff, they were unwelcome evidence of a relationship between the National Socialists and Zionism during the 1930s. And that continued right up until about 10, 20 years ago. When was it that book came out, Dennis, in Canada?
Around about 1986, I think.
Yeah, 1986. So that continued for about 50 years. Mildenstein visited the United States in 1954, having been granted a visa to do so at the request of the government of West Germany. In January 1956, he asked the US Embassy in Bonn to help him obtain an exchange grant for journalists, although he was not one. And they say he wasn't a journalist. I think it's quite clear he was. It just wasn't officially one because he couldn't talk about what he'd done in the past. By then, a member of the Free Democratic Party, in May 1956, he was elected to its press committee, and in December 1956, a CIA report from Cairo confirmed that he had been employed by the Egyptian government of Gamal Abdel Nasser to work for its Voice of the Arabs radio station. In June 1960, soon after the capture of Eichmann by Mossad agents in Buenos Aires on 11th of May 1960, Mildenstein announced that he had had an operational relationship with the CIA and, as a former US intelligence agent, claimed immunity from prosecution. This relationship was neither confirmed nor denied by the CIA, and that is all I've been able to find out about that. So quite how long?
Yeah, I'm not surprised because the FBI is involved with the CIA as well.
Yeah, how long had he been working with the CIA for? And also Gamal Abdel Nasser, because I believe the Egyptian government, I believe they had quite a few ex-SS officers and ex-National Socialists that were working with them. The same in Syria. With Arab nationalism was helped out by the National Socialists. So maybe it was something to do with that. Voice of the Arabs, would that have been like Voice of Europe, the American...
Possibly, yeah, the radio, yeah.
Yeah, anti-communist thing.
Yeah.
But okay. Interesting story anyway about a relationship between Germans and Jews that you just would not have expected to hear, I think. Got any final thoughts on that, Dennis?
Oh, yeah. It's just a shame that Israel... I've always had this intent on ruling the world. If you could just calm down and get on with people, you know, the world would be a better place.
It does show that, doesn't it? It does show that at this time, it wasn't like that. It was just building a homeland for their people. But I guess that, you know, all of our people should really be wanting to rule the world, to be honest. And I think if it was ruled by white people, it would be a much better place. But we don't think that. We think, oh, no, who would want to rule the world? And then when we give that up and we don't take dominion, because we're told in the Bible that we should take dominion, and if we don't take dominion, somebody else is going to take dominion. If we don't take dominion...
Yeah, it's just the fact that, you know, they've said that if there's any threat, they're going to use the Samson Project. I don't think there's any need for it. Well, there is, because they want to conquer the world, like, but what I'm saying, if they didn't want to conquer the world, there wouldn't be any need for a Samson Project.
Well, what they say is they're always under threat because they've been pogromed so many times and because of the Holocaust and all the rest of it. So they need to have weapons to defend themselves. And that's their logic for why they have the Samson project or whatever it is. And yeah. If anyone doesn't know what that is, that's nuclear weapons pointed at every capital in the world. And if Israel gets attacked, then it will press the button and every capital in the world will be hit by a nuclear bomb and they'll take the whole world out. And that's not an official policy of theirs. That is an unofficial policy of theirs. But people say that it's true.
Mm.
And that's what you're referring to there, Dennis. Well, let's move back to Ingrid Veckert's book. After covering the Havarah Agreement, we moved on to the other agreement, the Rubli-Wolfat Agreement, which was for Jews to move anywhere else but Palestine. And this was continually sabotaged by Ernst von Weizsäcker, who refused to put the Jewish representative Rubli in touch with the German diplomats needed to make the arrangements. Eventually, Hitler heard about this, and he personally stepped in, authorising Schacht to make all the arrangements necessary with Rubli and to start with the programme as soon as possible. And that's where we got to last week. If anyone wants to hear the details of that, how that happened, that's in last week. So the basic idea of the agreement was, by establishing trust funds, which would comprise 25% of the wealth belonging to Jews in Germany, and Jewish emigration would be financed through foreign loans. Each emigrant would, in addition to receiving the requisite amount of cash for entry, the Vorsorgegeld, receive a minimum amount of capital necessary to establish himself. About 150,000 able-bodied Jews were marked for emigration and their next of kin were to follow later. The Intergovernmental Committee would concern itself with which countries the Jews could migrate to. All Jews over 45 were to be able to remain in Germany and be protected from discrimination. Residential and work restrictions for these Jews were to be lifted. So they obviously weren't in prison camps, were they? If they needed protecting, if they needed protecting from discrimination, they weren't in prison camps. And obviously, it says here they had some restrictions, and they would be lifted for these Jews that were going to move out of the country or emigrate. The text of the memorandum on the Rubli-Wolfat Agreement was an official contract. Rubli wrote it up after his return to London and sent it to Wolfat. Weizsäcker hesitated to sign it because the foreign ministry had not been involved in the negotiations, something which he himself had prevented. And as we said last week, Hitler overruled it and said he wanted to do this and he sent somebody else in to do it. Therefore, it was Hermann Göring who presented the text to Adolf Hitler, who wholeheartedly assented to it. For his part, Rubli passed the text to the Intergovernmental Committee, made up of the representatives of 30 countries. The committee gave Rubli the task of informing Wolfat that these countries had taken note of the agreement with interest and that they would do everything to facilitate the emigration of Jews from Germany on its basis. But in practice, this support proved less than promised. But that was not the fault of the agreement or of its German initiators. So once again, it's the rest of the world that has let them down here. The Germans have set the agreement up. They've said, we'll provide the funds for this. We'll provide the legal side of it. And we'll facilitate it so that the Jews can move to these other countries. And you've got 30 countries, representatives of them say, yeah, that's great. We'll sort this out and we'll let the Jews come to our countries. And then when it comes down to it, they wouldn't let them.
Amazing. I think there was somebody advised, I think it was the guy who sent over his understudy over to check the camps. He advised Roosevelt to send a ship back full of Jews back to Israel for whatever reason, but they didn't want them.
There was quite a bit of emigration that continued, even once it was illegal, even once the war had started, and the SS were still helping the Jews to actually get out of the country. There's records of that, and smuggling them into Palestine, even when the war was on, as we'll get to. After successfully concluding the negotiations, the 72-year-old Rubley resigned from his post as director of the Intergovernmental Committee. In England, a finance company was founded with startup capital of $1 million. And in the United States, Jewish bankers pledged to raise enough capital to guarantee the realization of every settlement project. The new director of the Intergovernmental Committee, Sir Herbert Emerson, was convinced that the emigration of Jews had been secured and that it would be completed in 3 to 5 years' time. In January 1939, the Reich Center for Jewish Emigration was founded in Berlin. Its work was based on the Rubley-Wolfat Agreement, and it cooperated closely with the Reich Jewish Association in order to simplify the emigration process. So they're setting everything up so that they can achieve what they wanted to achieve, so that the Jews can go where they want to go, the Zionist Jews can go to Palestine, and they can build Israel, and the Germans can have the Germans in Germany. And everybody would have been happy. But they had to then start invading Germany, didn't they? They had to start making war.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Well, the process began slowly because most countries refused to take in Jewish immigrants. But at least the Rubley-Wolfat Agreement had removed all the financial barriers. Of this period, Rubley later wrote, "The Germans fulfilled all their obligations. In the months between my departure from Germany and the outbreak of war, few, if any, Jewish persecutions occurred in Germany. Some left and the rest had it easier in Germany. I received quite a number of letters from Germany wherein Jews thanked me for what I had done for them." With the outbreak of war, hopes of finding countries to which to emigrate diminished. The Royal Navy blocked the previously used sea routes, and Palestine was practically closed to immigration because the British had severely tightened the requirements for entry. So again, we can see there that Jews are not locked up in camps, and they're writing to him and saying life is much better now, and everything is set up for them to go, and then the war got in the way.
Yeah, I just wish it.
Sorry? You've just gone silent, Dennis.
What I was going to say, I just wish Hollywood and some historians, I wish they'd have just told us about it earlier.
Well, this is it, isn't it? This sounds much more believable, doesn't it, than what we're actually told. Yeah. The emigration routes then went overland, for example, through Greece and Turkey. On the 18th and the 21st of June 1940, the Jüdisch Nachrichtenblatt revealed an adventurous route via Yokohama to America. A map showed the new travel routes: Berlin, Warsaw, Moscow, Chita, Shanghai, Yokohama, San Francisco, Los Angeles. From there on, either in easterly direction to Chicago and New York, or south to Mexico, Panama, Santiago de Chile. The German government offered Jews with valid visas a route through occupied France to Spain and Portugal, from where they could then travel to their destination by ship. That Jewish emigration continued even after the war began was principally due to, first, the international connections of the Jews, and second, to the assistance of the German bureaucracies, and finally, to an organisation that was later to play a completely different role, the Mossad Le'Aliyabet. And we should probably leave getting into the Mossad until next week, but the Mossad itself was actually formed in order to help out with this immigration.
Mm-hmm.
So another surprise there, because obviously it went on to become the secret service of Israel, the intelligence agency. It was actually started up to continue with these emigration agreements that have been set up by the Germans once the rest of the world tried to put a stop to it. So the Mossad were working with the German administration as well as the Zionist organizations. And of course, you know, that's a recipe for the conspiracy theorists, isn't it?
Well, it makes you wonder, doesn't it, what is really the real story in a lot of cases. Certainly, you know, there's things coming out now which a while back people wouldn't believe, but the truth comes out, as I said.
Well, Truthful Out, as the name of the podcast is. And it's been interesting finding all this stuff out for me, because I knew about the Havara agreement, but I didn't know how closely they had actually worked together, and how it challenges the narrative that Jews were all put in camps and there was a plan to gas them. I mean, why would you have a plan to exterminate these people if you've made all these arrangements for them to move to the countries that they want to move to, which they were quite happy about? And they were quite happy to do. It was the Zionists that approached the National Socialists and said, look, let's work together. We want our people to go to Palestine, and we want to build a homeland there. So let's work together. So why would you then want to mistreat these people and exterminate them when you could have had a positive relationship with them? And there are reports of Jews that were in Germany saying that life really didn't change for them. It changed for those who were communists and who were against the National Socialist State. But the actual legal position was that they were a guest.
I think it's in some Jewish interests that the Nazis are demonised, because now it's... It's not just the Germans want to get nicked. It's all white races. So
you're not going to mistreat your guests, are you?
Well, you wouldn't have thought so, would you? Although I've known Stalin do it.
I mean, obviously, if you're at home and your family, obviously your family mean more to you. But when you have a guest around, you know, you give them, depending on the guest, you might give them your finest china. But you don't mistreat them. You don't say, well, because you're a guest, you're not entitled to everything that the family are. Whatever the family have, your guest is offered to as well. But he's a guest. He doesn't have a say in, you know, who your daughter marries, or a say in the way that the house is run. And that was the situations. You had citizens in Germany who were German, and that was their inheritance, was the fact that they were German, so they were citizens. And then you had guests, and the guests could be Jews, they could be mixed race offspring from the Rhineland, could be the Arabs.
What's strange is that the communists outside of Germany, in America, the Jews, they wanted the Jews reinstated, while the Zionists wanted the Jews to go down to Israel. So there's a conflict even at that level.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? And the ones that did actually go back there, they were the ones that were in America, and I think they were part of the bureaucracy, weren't they?
They must be part of somewhere.
I mean, they were sort of to do with the politicians and the civil service and things like that, because there were quite a few that went back, and then they became part of the administration in the Soviet part of Germany.
Yeah,
quite a few of them.
I can imagine.
Came back and were commissars. So again, it's a particular class of Jew that wanted to go back.
Yeah.
Rather than the ones that went to Palestine. I don't think any of the ones that went to Palestine came back.
I don't think they did. No, but the communism as an ideology is to take over the world. So it's going to be conflict when people are concentrating on Zionism, which is probably why the Soviet Union didn't let the Jews out after Stalin split with the Allies.
Yeah, well, when you're saying about Zionism wanting to take over the world, I mean, communism was international, and communism wanted to take over the world. And then you've got the religious side of Judaism, which says that they should take over the world. So both of them have this push to be leading the world. And today the Jews will try and put it in positive terms. They call it Tikkun Olam, healing the world. And wouldn't you want to do things in the Jewish way? And they'll try to put it in a positive spin. But it is still trying to control the world. And as I say, it'd be so much better with white people running it, which is how it used to be in the past. And that's what white people were worried about losing. That's what they meant by white supremacy, was the supremacy of law and order and civilization, and all the best parts of the European character: charity, justice, mercy, treating those better off, treating those less well off than you in a good way, and setting a good example. All of these things were seen as being a part of being a white man. The white man's burden, they called it, didn't they? Of having to look after these other peoples. And wouldn't you really rather have somebody like that that was running things? And that's why it says in the Bible, man has to take dominion. Because if a good man doesn't take dominion, then a bad man will. And the problem I see it today is we've forgotten that. We think everybody just wants equality. Nobody wants to rule the world. And they do, you know, I'm sure the Chinese would like to if they could.
Yeah, sure would, communists.
It's only us that seem to have forgotten that there's this ongoing struggle. And, you know, the point of life is to get on top of it and to progress and make life better for your people. And in the process, you make life better for everyone else. You can certainly say that the British Empire made life better for Africans and Indians, if you're going by the number of Africans and Indians that there are now, because they've just exploded in demographics, because life has been made so much easier for them with medicine and with food and with technology. So by having the white men administering the country, it actually improved the life for them.
Standard of living, yeah, that's true. But, you know, at the end of the day, the story is that, you know, Israel's going to rule. And in fact, there's something I think it's the Talmud, where they each has 200 slaves.
Well, there is. That's what it says in the Talmud, isn't it? That the Jews will rule the world. So it's not like we're saying they're trying to be anti-Semitic or anything. It's just the way that it is. People need to be aware of these things, because that's the way that life is, and that's all of this has played out in history. And what happened in Germany is also very important. And there are other ways that things could have been gone about, in the way that the National Socialists did with the Zionists, and this peaceful separation. And it's just such a great shame that that was not allowed to continue. And instead, we had to have a great big war that ended up with 40 million Europeans dead, and lots of Jews dead as well. And the majority of Jews, I'm sure, believe that 6 million of them were gassed. And, you know, they might as well have been. If they're going to believe that happened to them, it might as well have actually happened to them. It's just the outcome of the war was just terrible all round. Not good for Jews, and certainly not good for Europeans either. Well, we've gone a little bit over time, Dennis, so we better finish. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on today.
No problem.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.